from the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Chapter 3. Part 2. Be careful. Don't fall asleep in assumptions. So Shen is suggesting something slightly different. It suggests that before you proceed into the effortful process of trying to change yourself, maybe you should look at yourself to see whether you have truly seen yourself before you try to change. So in this case, the function of meditation is to create an environment in which we can attend to the experience of being and how it stands in relation to the way in which different movements are occurring. We directly open to our presence, and then we can see what is going on. We are observing the contents of our experience, perceptions of the external world coming through our senses, sounds, colour, shapes, taste, tactile sensation, and so on. We also experience the internal sensations of our body and our feelings, memories, thoughts, and conceptualizations. As this stream of experience is arising, we can see that we designate some of this as self and some of it as other. For example, if I look out of the window, I can see a winter tree with all its leaves gone. I, here, see the tree there. The sense of here and there, of me and it, is an interpretation. Actually, directly, the whole field of experience is arising at once. When I relax the interpretive process, there is experience. Direct, ungraspable experience. This creates a space within which the facticity, the actuality of unfolding experience is revealed. It is what it is. This is always available, yet is unattended to when I am focused on telling the world what it is. These two aspects or modes are simultaneously present, yet one, the direct, is invisible while the other, the conceptual, is highly visible and seems to be a given. If someone asks you, "What's that building over there?" as you answer their question, they have very gently wound you into the world of conceptions, a world in which they function and you function. You have the freedom to perform your existence as a human being with other human beings, an interaction mediated through language. But what is the experience prior to the interpretation provided by language, memory, and concept? Something occurs. If we don't conceptualize our experience, we still have experience. In conceptualizing experience, we think about what is happening out there and what is happening to me in here. And this activity confirms to us that I am the one to whom it is happening. These are all conceptual interpretations. The point of view of Dzogchen is that we need to be careful not to fall asleep in the delusion that I just am. I'm just me. This is who I am. And these are the kind of thoughts I have. It seems to be a common belief that there is nothing to be inspected. I'm over 21. I'm entitled to lead my own life. I claim autonomy. Yet, no matter how much autonomy we claim, we hear noises, we see appearances, The world intrudes, enters into us before we have a chance to control it. To be in the world is to have the noise. So, where is the autonomy? Experience and our first response occur before we make a conscious choice. To be alive is to be part of the unfolding field. Our manifestation is always within the shared field. Autonomy and individuality are deluding concepts which help us to ignore the actuality of the non-duality of manifestation. People get to you. They disturb you. They annoy you. Why is that? Why can't they just leave me alone? Because you don't leave them alone. If you can guarantee that you will stop thinking about other people and having judgments and opinions about them, and stop looking at other people when you walk down the street, if you can guarantee to seal yourself completely in a bubble of yourself, then we'll accept your autonomy. However, nobody can do that, because to be alive is to be related. It's not that I am related to you as if we were two separate entities which just happened to be linked by circumstance. Rather, what I call I is the vehicle of relating. What you call you is the vehicle of relating. There is an interplay between both of our experiences of being in the world with others. I am constituted out of the stream of experience, and everything I encounter through my senses is also a stream of experience. From this point of view, there is no firm boundary between self and other. Outer and inner ceaselessly commingle. So, how could we not expect to be disturbed by other people? Some people disturb or impact us in ways that we like. And some people disturb us and impact us in ways that we don't like. Either way, we are going to be impacted. We are part of the movement of the world, as is everybody else. We are all moving in a field of movement. There is no individual self-substance. This is not in itself frightening. It might feel a little strange, but actually, it is the guarantor of our freedom, the freedom to relate, the freedom to participate, the freedom to be part of what is going on. We do not live our lives from a clear vantage point, observing, then deciding on the basis of rational choice. No one lives like that. That's just a fantasy. It's an anti-phenomenological story, a story that goes against the direct experience of being alive. We are breathing in and breathing out. We are moving within the world. The world is moving within us. Blood is going around our body. Hormones are communicating. Many, many kinds of communication are happening all at the same time. In fact, we can say that our human body and all living bodies are nothing but communication. Communication is the energy exchange which maintains the fairly self-regulating forms which constitute our world. We, and everything around us, are patterns of energy manifesting in communication and interaction with other forms. At certain points, we get a bit sick. Eventually, we die. And then, some of the regulating factors cease to operate and the body starts to decompose. Being alive is the operation of the factors which maintain a certain patterning of other factors which manifest as our body. The balancing of these dynamic factors is unstable and is always under threat. For example, we get colds, like the one I have now. We meet with other people and talk, and something comes out of their system and comes into our energetic field, and we respond to that and find that we have a cold. It stays for a while. We do certain things because of it, and then it's gone. That is to say, we are called into our current pattern of becoming by events in the world. When you walk up the stairs, the nature of the stairs is determining how you walk. Our sense that I'm climbing the stairs is a statement of individual agency. I know how to climb stairs. I've been climbing them for years. This is just another set of stairs. Watch, and I'll show you how you do it. Yes, I am the one who climbs the stairs, but I am climbing these stairs. And the particular shape of these stairs determines how I move my legs. So the stair and our body are in conversation. We can't just climb these stairs as if they were any old stairs, for some stairs have a higher step than others, and that will make our body move differently. If you start to see the world in this way, you get a decentering of the sense of being an individual agent who is in control. People who drive cars are out on the road with other cars. You can't just drive your car as a first-person singular event, for you're driving with other people. You're sharing the space of the road. And how they drive will also determine how you drive, how much space you want away from them, whether it seems safe to overtake them or not. If they become a bit erratic, you become a bit wary. This sort of event reaction is going on all the time. When you're chopping vegetables, how much force you use depends on the kind of vegetable you're chopping. If you're chopping up a turnip, then you need more force than with a parsnip, and a tomato needs less force than a parsnip. This is pretty obvious. Who is determining that? Again, you can tell the story, oh, I know how to chop tomatoes. But the tomato is making you chop it in a particular way. The tomato is speaking to you. It's saying, if you hit me hard, I'm going to splash you. So we listen to the tomato, and we are very careful because the skin can be quite tough. And if we cut it at the wrong angle, the knife will slide off. The world is communication. The world is the revelation of shared existence, the shared experience that we have. This is the particular Dzogchen reading of the general Buddhist notion of the absence of inherent self-nature in phenomena, including people. The aspects of our experience are always in communication. For example, some people here are sitting on the floor and are less used to sitting cross-legged. So every now and then they move because their knees will tell them something is not quite right. Others are sitting on seats which are a little bit hard, and so they move around because the back gets sore and the bum gets sore. In this simple way, being alive is ceaseless communication. Approaching Dzogchen. Observing the nature of our identity. The first approach in Dzogchen is to start to listen to yourself in the world, as part of the world, rather than listening to yourself, telling yourself about the world. We are very, very good at telling stories about our experience. That's what we do all the time. Someone says, "How are you doing?" And we're off telling a story. "I was here, I was there, and then I did this and did that." Whereas in Dzogchen, we focus on observing the co-emergence of the energy of openness, the arising of what we take to be outside and what we take to be inside are not two different things. Subject and object exist in non-duality, which simply means that there is not just one thing, nor are there many different things. The non-dual is the intimate co-emergence or co-presence of all our experience and its ground. However, our education has pointed us in another direction. What we learnt when in school and later indicated that we have to take care of ourselves. It's a hard world out there, and if you don't look after you, who's going to do it? So we can often become a bit wary. For sometimes we have painful love stories or a painful work experience and then find it difficult to trust people. What are you up to? How can I work out who you are? Or what's going on? These are the bruises round the heart which can lead to a kind of hypervigilance, a sense that the only way to be safe is to be in control. This is very sad because actually we can't be in total control, which means there's no way to be safe. Now you can hear this in two ways. One way is, there's nowhere to be safe. Shit, what am I going to do? This is really not nice and I don't want all this. This is horrible. Another way is to hear it in a more neutral way, as a simple fact that there is no way to be safe. Just as it's a fact that today is called Sunday, this world is not safe. This is not a punishment, nor even a sign that we should improve our situation. Rather, it is an encouragement to stop looking at the object for the answer. If what is occurring is unsatisfactory, perhaps this has something to do with how we experience it. Perhaps we need to observe ourselves instead of focusing on manipulating events. Who is the one who wants life to be safe? Me. I've got to protect this body because this is who I am. This seems obvious, yet we might benefit from observing the nature of our identity. Who is the one who says, "I am me"? "I am me" is a string of words. And when you start swimming in the ocean of language, these gentle, warm waves break over your face like swimming in the Mediterranean on a beautiful summer's day. The sky is blue. The sea is warm. "I am me. I am me." It's so easy being alive. But we are swimming, which is an activity, and if we stop swimming, we drown. You've got to keep language going. You've got to keep thinking. We are keeping ourselves afloat by thinking and speaking. We are the active maintainers of the bubble of ourselves. Just as children have little water wings on their arms when they learn to swim, so we have the bubble of our self, which seems to keep us afloat, maintaining our identity, but only if we keep inflating it. Meditation helps us to inquire whether we actually need the water wings. Do we need to keep swimming? Who is the one who keeps swimming? Who is the one wearing the water wings? That is to say, if I don't make meaning, if I don't make my life meaningful, will it be meaningless? If I have to keep generating meaning, it will be conventional. It will be according to certain shared rules. This is clearly the case, because if somebody entirely makes their own world on their own terms, they tend to end up in contact with psychiatric services. A reasonable life tends to be one which has a degree of conformity with social convention. By aligning ourselves with the patterns of interpretation that are in our world, we feel okay. Every now and then, something might happen where we meet people with whom we are not quite sure what the deal is. For example, if you have to go into hospital or have contact with lawyers, that can be a bit weird because these situations are very clearly defined worlds. Worlds which operate on their own terms. In encountering them, you have to leave your thoughts about what's reasonable and what's not reasonable at the door. Generally, we prefer to hang out with people where we feel at ease because their assumptions and behaviour confirms our own. But clearly, this will keep us in quite a small world, like a little clearing in the dark forest. Uncertainty lurks in the shadows which we avoid. When I get old, what will happen to me? Who will look after me? Encountering the unknown, our self-construct starts to crumble, and we become anxious because it can't be maintained. Once you move into retirement, what's the basis for your identity? As the economy gets worse and many people lose their jobs, anxiety increases. We know that redundancy is a big cause of mental distress, generating depression and anxiety. Why? Well, on an outer level, there's a loss of money and so on, which alters our behaviour. But this is also a loss of identity. The sense of who we are can no longer be maintained. There's the howling space around us. What will I say to other people? How will they think of me if I can't show them the nicely defined little box of my life? Teachings given at Bright Elm Centre, Brighton, UK, on the 2nd of December, 2012. Revised by James Lowe. From the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, August 2025.